I have written out a statement, and I do that in your defense, because if I don't write it out, I'll ramble on for an hour. And after I've read the statement, if you have questions, I'd be very glad to try to respond to them. In 1975, when I retired from the Congress, I must remind you I did not retire from the political scene. I couldn't lose interest. I witnessed the shame of the so-called White House plumbers and the pendulum of public interest swinging to lethargy and disgust. And I thought then that we must not ever let this happen again. Under my party, I saw the national budget climbing till today it's reached, as you all know, about $500 billion. Some of us tried in the mid-60s to stop some of those great society programs with their waste and their duplication and sometimes outright corruption, programs which did not work then and many of them which are not working today. And they fed the fires of inflation. Public protest at that time was ignored. I am concerned that we may be witnessing a similar train of events in Oregon. One is a cover-up in progress in the state of Oregon now. The state budget has doubled in 4 years from $1 billion to $2 billion, again, feeding those fires of inflation. When over 200,000 people sign petitions saying that the property taxes are too high, what kind of a response do you get? Oh, they're wrong. They're dead wrong. And I must say, Vic, out of that 200,000, I think over half of them have to be Democrats. But they say the people are wrong, and we'll find a way to kill six. When 40,000 people signed a petition saying that we want the Mount Hood Freeway, what was the response? Elected officials said, they're wrong. They're dead wrong. We're going to kill the Mount Hood Freeway. I must say to you that I am dismayed when the governor and the mayor, whom I've known and like very much as individuals, I've known them for 20 years, I'm dismayed when they use as a weapon to kill six the argument that it will help business in Oregon. You'd almost think it was a sin. And yet, it was precisely these same people who engineered a plan to help a foreign business to the tune of several million dollars. They were the ones who led the fight with our tax dollars to buy at $45,000 an acre land and sell it to a German business at $14,000 an acre, and there were a good many acres. And we've not yet really heard the price tag that is going to result in moving the rock quarry and building the roads and the streets that will be required. I wonder why it's okay to use our tax dollars to the tune of several million to help a foreign business, but apparently it would be a sin if Oregon business received any help from Measure 6. And I'm advised that about 95% of all of the Oregon businesses qualify as small business. It's the mom and pop service station in lots of towns, the small family restaurant, the family hardware store, the insurance office in the den of the home, the nonprofit apartment house, for instance, that my church runs for low-income elderly people, property on which we pay a tax. Today, I've just decided I can't remain silent any longer. I want to change. I'm actively supporting Vic Atieh for governor, and not because he's a Republican, but in spite of the fact that he's a Republican. It just happens that I think he's the better candidate. I want a governor, first of all, who listens and respects the voice of 200,000 people instead of saying they're wrong, dead wrong. Vic Atieh said, let's not kill six. Let's improve six. Let's make six work. He tried precisely that, if you recall, in the six-day special session of the Oregon legislature, and his endeavors failed by one vote, one vote. I'm convinced that in the next regular session, with him as governor and with his leadership, a new measure can be submitted to the voters which amends six, doesn't try to kill six. and the truly big businesses can be prevented from reaping a windfall. There can be fair and just assessments. And then I want a governor of my state who recognizes that inflation is the most cruel tax there is for the elderly, the retired people on fixed incomes. In making my decision, I happen to believe that Vicatia would not have allowed our state budget to double during these last 4 years if he had been governor. That also fed the fires of inflation. I want a governor who is in tune with the people, who leads and not follows. In January 1977, long before Proposition 13 even, Vicatia recognized the horrendous tax burden that is carried by the little people of this state. And because he felt that way, he introduced two bills to do something about it. Straub said that to refund tax surplus at that time was, quote, irresponsible. After Measure 6, Bob Straub recommends it. I've been deeply concerned about some of the allegations in the liquor control operation and now in workman's comp. I simply don't want any more cover-ups, and I hope we're not seeing one. I'm convinced that Vicatia has so much respect for Oregonians and so much personal integrity that he would do everything possible to protect the people's right to know. It's for these reasons that I've decided that Vicatia would be a great governor, and I fully intend to support him. If you have any questions, I would be glad to try to respond to them. If I can't, well, you can. I think that the final straw was when you people in the press, at least, quoted Bob Straub as saying that if both 6 and 11 fail, he was asked what he would do about it, and his response was that I wouldn't do anything. I think that really was the final thing that persuaded me that an awful lot of people want both 6 and 11 to fail, and then they can continue as they have in the past.
So. Have you had differences with Governor Straub through the years, or is this more recent than that, you're falling out with him?
No, we really have, I think all people who are in political life have disagreements. Tom McCall and I ran against each other in 54. We've become very good friends. Bob Straub and I have been good friends, I guess with one major exception, and that was in 59 and 60 when I was the chairman for John Kennedy's campaign in Oregon. And he was violently opposed to Kennedy, and we had some sharp words at that time. But I think that's probably the only major disagreement. It's just really a result of things that have happened in fairly recent months.
In the next 2 weeks, will you actively campaign?
I will. I have other commitments I have to keep, but I will help in any way that I can if they feel that my help would be of help.
I think it's important that Edith Green has, who happens to be a Democrat. And I would say, and I'm anxious to tell you that I wouldn't trade one Edith Green for a whole flock of Carters, and I don't think Oregonians will either. I'm just very proud of the fact that she has done this, and I understand what she's doing, and it impresses me very much, and I deeply appreciate it.
Vic, did she come to you, or did you go to Mrs. Green?
Well, I think it was almost a mutual thing that happened almost simultaneously. We were thinking about it, and I think it actually started out in casual conversation, and we didn't make a direct contact until we thought there was great hope for it. It just sort of happened, I guess. It wasn't anything we out looking for people. It just sort of happened.
Mrs. Green, you also endorsed former President Gerry Ford. One would almost think that you maintain your registration in the Democratic Party just so you can throw your support over to Republicans and say, look at that, a Democrat.
I think that's a legitimate question. I'm one of those, I guess I was born, is that what you say, a Democrat? I was born into a Democratic family. Jerry Ford was the first Republican candidate I ever supported for President of the United States. I think my record, you know, is clear on that, right down the line. And I, one of the wonderful memories is the very close association I had with Harry Truman, with John Kennedy. I traversed the state with him, east and west, north and south. I was Bob Kennedy's chairman. I was very fond of Hubert Humphrey. I guess this isn't really the place where I should stress by Democratic leadings. But I am a Democrat, and I'm proud of it. I don't know whether I should say to Vic that, you know, quote one of my favorite Democrats, Adlai Stevenson, that we do missionary work and believe in forgiveness of sins. and I, in this election, there are only two Republicans that I'm supporting, and I don't know how many candidates are on the ballot. How many are on that laundry sheet? 40?
Well, there's a lot.
You know, there are an awful lot of candidates. Out of the whole list, there would be only two Republicans that I will be Hatfield. But I that may offend some of the people in the room. Maybe I better get out. But it seems to me that when two candidates, you have two candidates and one is clearly superior to the other, that you really should not be blinded by partisanship views and do that to the sacrifice of what's good for the state of the nation. And that's my view, and I'm sure that some think I'm a heretic. I have no apologies to make. I've done it. I intend to continue to do it. When I think a Republican is clearly superior to the Democratic candidate who's running, I intend to support him and let the chips fall where they may.
Thank you very much.
Can I ask you one more question?
Yes.
In regards to Measure 10, I understand that you are against Measure 10.
That's correct.
But I'm not sure why. Can you tell me that, please?
It's because I'm convinced it would create more litigation, and we are about to settle down on the process. Comprehensive plans are about to be finished in cities and counties. Litigation has already occurred to define much of our statutes. I just didn't want to open up the whole new world again for more litigation, and that's why. I was totally unaware of that. It came as a matter of fact, learned about it yesterday, and I was totally surprised. I didn't even hear about it.
So you would take issue with Kramer's statement that L.B. Dane is just your hatchet man?
Oh, yes, yes. It surprised me. And I didn't learn about it until, actually, we read about it in the newspaper, and that's when I learned about it first of all. So it was a total surprise on my part. If you know L.B. Day, you know he's going to do his thing. thank you all very much for coming. I appreciate it very much. Thank you.
Gangplank from the dock to the edge of the barge. Now, they only had one handrail on it because they were having to haul welding equipment up and down, and you simply couldn't get it between the handrails. The OSHA inspector cited them and said you have to have two handrails on a gangplank. The Nichols people said, well, suppose we just had a ladder up there. And he said, that would be great. You don't have to have any handrails on a ladder. We look at picker cabins. Do you realize quite familiar with this because up in our part of the world they use lots of them. The grower cannot rent a motel room at the Hood River Inn and put a picker in there because the motel room does not comply with the standard for picker cabins. And again, try to change some of these regulations. Well, I think it can be done, but it's going to take a lot of hard work by the people. Unfortunately, at the congressional level, it is virtually impossible to get any input into a federal regulation. I have seen it time after time after time. When Congressman Ullman or Senator Hatfield or Senator Packwood came to our area, they saw something that was not right with a federal agency, and there was no way they could get at them. At least yet in the state of Oregon, we still have a fair shot the elected official, of having some input into our state boards and commissions. And in fact, I originally put in a bill which was declared at that point to be unconstitutional, that said would have established a legislative review board made up of 10% of the legislature, who had to pass on every regulatory measure that, or administrative rule, that was being promulgated by one of Oregon's boards or commissions. It was declared unconstitutional because of the separation of powers doctrine, which said that the legislature creates the board or commission, gives them certain powers, then you turn them over to the governor, and from there on they become a part of the executive department, and the legislature can't tamper with the executive department. This last session, or the one before, they actually have what is called legislative council. They do review the rules, and they are making some waves so far as having some little control over the type of rules being promulgated by Oregon's various boards and commissions. There is more law being made by regulatory agencies than by the elected officials all put together. Now, I'd like to take just a second or two to talk to you about ballot measure 13. Our time is running out, and I know if there was a question and answer period, that's probably one of the very early ones you would ask, and I'm going to just run through it quickly. I want to make it very positive here that I am not appearing today as a proponent or opponent. Rather, I would like to explain, as I see, the possibilities of ballot measure 13 as it might apply to Oregon. The Jarvis-Gann Amendment was picked up by the Oregon people who are circulating petitions right now, and unfortunately they did not apply it to the Oregon Constitution, which is different than California's. They simply took the Jarvis-Gann Amendment, they changed the 1% to 1.5%, and are now circulating a petition to get it on the Oregon ballot. In other words, the limitation on property taxes would be 1.5% in the state of Oregon. I'm not exactly sure what you are here. Portland is about $26, or 26% now, 2.6%, $26 a thousand, and this would limit that to $15 a thousand. The Oregon Constitution says that a political subdivision can increase their tax base by 6% each year without a vote of the people. And here is a classic example. Multnomah County, City of Portland, and Multnomah School District 1 each operate generally within their tax base. Constitution says, okay, you can go up 6% a year on that tax base and you don't have to go to the people. Here is a proposal that, yeah, you can do that, but the limitation is going to be 1.5%. With the tax rate in Portland now being $26 a thousand, and this limits it to $15 a thousand, who gets the money if this should pass? In other words, there's no provision for allocation when the $15 per thousand doesn't raise what the other section of the Constitution says they're entitled to. And the attorneys I've talked to, and I've talked with many, don't exactly know about that one at all. Another thing our Oregon Constitution says is that all property shall be uniformly taxed. Let's take a couple of tract houses that were purchased back in 1975 by two individuals who have lived side by side. The present true cash value, if this passes, would be rolled back to 1975. Then they allow a 2% increase in the assessed valuation per year until the house is sold, and at that point it goes back to today's market value. From 1975, let's say in 1980, these houses are identical, and they're both on the tax rolls. They started at $50,000. If you take 2% a year, I don't know where that would be, $55,000. But with inflation, this house over here sells for $80,000. Okay, all of a sudden, this one's on the tax rolls at $80,000, and his neighbor is still on at $55,000. Identical houses built at the same time. So here's one section of the Oregon Constitution that says all property shall be uniformly taxed, and this proposed amendment would allow a variation. And the attorneys, again, aren't exactly sure what would happen. two-thirds of the qualified electors in a district would be required to increase property taxes in that district above what the Constitution says. Now, I have posed this question to some of the attorneys, and they don't know the answer either. It says on the petition, two-thirds of the qualified electors must agree before this tax base can be raised above the constitutional prohibition. Does that mean all of the people in the district that are qualified to vote, or does it mean two-thirds of those that actually arrive at the polls? And the attorneys, even the constitutional lawyers, aren't exactly sure what that means. I bring this out to you because I know there will be lots of questions on it. The opponents, and I've given you some of the opponent arguments, the opponents say that it will be totally disastrous to the political subdivisions of the state of Oregon. I am totally in agreement with some kind of tax limitation. The only way you're ever going to get at government is through a tax limitation. I'm not sure it's property tax, but a tax limitation, because the politician will spend every cent that you'll give him or her. The proponents of this particular measure say that since houses change hands traditionally in Oregon every 7 years, that over a period of time the house valuations will continue to rise so that you will not have this great loss in tax revenues. Then comes the opponent who says, well, that's fine, except that businesses don't change that fast, so the businesses are going to have a big windfall because the houses, as the true cash value rises but theirs aren't, they're going to be paying a disproportionate share of the property tax. I think my time is up according to my watch. I wanted to just go through that very briefly for you. My suggestion is that you study the issue very carefully, and if it does get on the ballot, particularly study it very carefully. Even the people who are passing the petitions out and promoting this issue in the state of Oregon, and I had quite a chat with one of them Saturday, admit that it is defective, but they say the courts will square it away. I wanted to bring it to your attention today because the measure as it is now written for the state of Oregon does not apply to our Constitution, has a lot of flaws in it, but again, I understand that people are getting darn sick and tired of government spending. It's been a great pleasure to be with you today.
Thank you, Paul.